Those smartphones that belong to you or someone you know may not be quite smart enough to ward off viruses or other kinds of electronic attacks. So we've called in Morning Edition's technology commentator Mario Armstrong to tell us how worried we should be, if at all. Hi, Mario.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. I got to tell you, my wife has been probably hoping for years that this BlackBerry that I carry around will be attacked by a virus and destroyed. So this is really sort of a good news story. But how possible is it that something could happen to it?
Very possible. These mobile phones are more readily available. I say that people in America carry three things, and that's your wallet, your keys, and a mobile phone. So there's a large enough market for hackers or those to want to attack these devices. So it's just a matter of time before we see some type of major outbreak.
Well, I've got a spyware program on my laptop that I ran just the other day.
That's right, but you don't have that probably on your smartphone. Or if you did, you probably wouldn't know really how to use that. Or maybe no one's even mentioned to you, hey, have you thought about updating any antivirus software on your cell phone? So we're seeing much more of these devices, and the market for mobile security software has doubled more in 2008 and probably will continue to show some strong growth over the years to come, although I still think we need to see a major outbreak for something to really take off.
You mean a major outbreak that would really get it in the public consciousness?
That's correct. For having everyday people actually talking about or being in fear of their device or thinking about their data being compromised on their devices. Once it hits the kitchen table and people are talking about it, then we'll start to really see a market need for antivirus software on cell phones.
Are phones a little bit behind in this area because people haven't thought of it before? Because it just makes the phone a little cheaper not to worry about it? What?
There's a couple of things. There have been some attacks that have been out there, but they just haven't gone widespread. The PC market just still remains a more profitable target for cyber crooks. And then number two, another reason could be that mobile phones haven't really traditionally stored a lot of sensitive data, and that's what's changing. Now we are starting to use these devices in more complex ways, things for not only just email and getting news, but now using them for things like banking and even remote control types of devices.
So as this device in my hand merges toward being basically a computer, it is going to be just as vulnerable as the computer, which maybe it really wasn't in the past.
That's right, and maybe even more so vulnerable because I have access to things that I could do. Like, for example, if I was to run some type of hacking software onto your cell phone, I could potentially then send a text message to everyone in your address book that could potentially download or click onto something or send them or redirect them to a website that could be false and try to acquire some other personal identification. So I could try to get it from the device itself, or I could try to phish people, and that is to send them into a trap for more personal information.
Two things that I'm sure are happening somewhere in America right now as we speak, Mario. One, a computer hacker is taking a couple of notes on what you're saying and saying, very nice idea. I could try that. And the other thing is there must be some company that's getting ready to make some money off this selling protection.
And that's where we've seen a lot of changes, because we see a lot of market hype in terms of, ooh, let's watch out for our phones. They could be tapped. They could be compromised. And that is true. I don't want to make it seem like it's all hype. But at the same time, it seems that a lot of the hype is coming from antivirus companies. I mean, I've been reading about one quote that said one in every 63 smartphones is vulnerable. Well, that report came from a company that sells antivirus software. I have seen data, though, that does suggest that about 500 mobile viruses have been launched in the last 5 years, but when you look at PCs, it's over 2 million viruses in the same time frame. So I just don't think that the antivirus companies yet have a market need. There hasn't been an outbreak to cause that consumer awareness. Although recently at the Black Hat Conference, which is basically an annual conference that brings together security professionals from all over the world, this was the first year at that conference that several panels and discussions were specifically about mobile security, and in fact, several different hacks were shown on multiple devices, from the iPhone to Google's Android. So this is a real situation and a real problem.
Mario Armstrong is host of Digital Cafe on public radio station WYPR in Baltimore. Mario, always good to talk with you.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
And you can find tips on how to protect your smartphone and get more technology coverage by checking out the new NPR.org.
Since the first days of powered flight, humans have been sharing the sky with birds. We don't always coexist peacefully, though. Over the last two decades, airplane bird strikes have killed more than 200 people around the world and cost the U.S. aviation industry hundreds of millions of dollars. NPR's Robert Benincasa reports on the search for a way to keep man and bird on separate flight paths.
The next time you get on an airplane, consider how far human flight has come. In 1930, it was still faster to travel across the country by train. Anyone fearless and wealthy enough to fly endured jarring flights in unpressurized cabins. Today's high-tech airplanes move us around the world so well, it's become routine. Still, there's one low-tech problem we haven't quite solved. Birds.
Cactus 1539 hit birds. We've lost thrust on both engines, returning back towards LaGuardia.
You probably recall what happened to that U.S. Airways flight back in January.
It was a bird strike. Can I get them in for runway 1?
Runway 1, that's good.
Cactus 1529, turn right 280. You can land runway 1 at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
We're going to be in the Hudson.
We're going to be in the Hudson, the words of pilot Chesley Sullenberger. He was forced to bring his plane down in the river after both engines sucked in geese and lost power. The bird strike problem has worsened in recent years as bird populations have grown. Most strikes happen at low altitudes near airports. So, until now, airport managers have tried to make the ground around airports inhospitable to birds. They've changed the vegetation the birds feed on or disturbed their rest with loud noises. But what if we could warn the birds away from an approaching aircraft in the sky? Brad Blackwell is a wildlife biologist for the Agriculture Department, and he's trying to break down the communication barrier between species.
Vision is the primary sensory pathway in birds. And so if we can play upon that sensory pathway, understand it, and use the lights that are on the aircraft basically to buy time for the aircraft, buy time for the birds.
All right, birds, here we go.
Enter the geese. We're at Plumbrook Station, a high-security government campus near Sandusky, Ohio. A member of Blackwell's team climbs into the back of a pickup truck and ushers four Canada geese into a neatly mowed, fenced-off circle 56 feet across. Cameras surround the birds, recording their every move. The geese, with their wings clipped, pad peacefully around the grass until Indiana State University biologist Stephen Lima comes on the scene.
Surprisingly, no one's actually looked at how planes approach birds and how they respond. It's never been done.
So Lima's doing it now with a model plane. It looks like a miniature Cessna, about 6 feet long with bright, white, pulsating LED lights mounted on it. Lima works the two joysticks on a radio control box, sending the plane aloft.
Right at him.
He flies the plane over the heads of the birds a few times, then brings it down in a rough landing.
Not bad for crosswind landing.
Getting a rise out of these geese is a challenge. They're city dwellers, rounded up in a Cleveland park. Like many of the birds near airports, they're well acclimated to human activity. And that's part of the problem.
They're obviously not afraid of this aircraft. It's a 9-foot wingspan that's coming right at them. They even challenge it in some cases. Then there is the ducking response, but they're definitely not taking initiative to get out of the way.
So what might warn the birds off? Qantas Airlines recently reported a reduction in bird strikes when it mounted pulsing lights on 737s. Blackwell's team wants to firm up the science behind those observations.
In this experiment, we run a treatment with aircraft approaching without lights and one with the lights.
And you want to know if the lights make a difference.
I want to know if the lights can make a difference, even if they give us a slight edge, and then can we tweak the system a little bit more? Can we start playing with wavelengths that these birds can see better?
Biologist Esteban Fernandez Hudasik looks at video from a previous day's flights in a nearby trailer.
The first reaction that you see is that the birds pull together and they group together very quickly as the airplane goes by. And then the second reaction that we can see here is that some individuals duck down right there.
The geese are ducking. They seem to regard the plane as a predator. The challenge is to make that predator as threatening as possible. But first, Fernandez needs to understand what the birds actually see.
Humans have 3 visual pigments, birds have 4 visual pigments. And this visual pigment usually is in the UV range, in the ultraviolet range. So birds can perceive more colors than humans can.
So we might end up someday with lights on aircraft that are ultraviolet that we can't see that the birds can.
We might.
For now, though, the secret of a finely tuned aerial warning system remains with the birds. Robert Benincasa, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Thanks to the Internet, the world has a lot more critics. Some are associated with well-established websites. Others make their views known through homemade blogs or videos. And when it comes to product reviews, many tech companies are discovering that they can't ignore some of their newest, more unusual critics. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports on one tech review in Redmond, Washington, where the critics are kids.
A surefire way to make yourself feel old and behind the times is to visit the headquarters of OmnitechNews.net. That would be the cramped bedroom of 12-year-old Robert Clark. He and two elementary school pals are taping their latest video podcast product review.
Start in 3, 2, 1. Hello, my name's Lucas, and welcome to show 46 of Omnitech News.
The pint-sized host is in T-shirt and shorts. He smoothly and confidently runs through the pros and cons of some new headphones from the company Skullcandy.
So I would give these headphones a solid 6 out of 10 if you really want to.
2.5 minutes later, it's a wrap.
That was great. Thanks, Lucas. It's good you gave him an honest rating, I think.
These internet videos routinely draw a couple hundred views. Viewership occasionally spikes into the thousands. Not bad for an enterprise powered by weeding and babysitting money and Carson Fujisaki's $2 a week allowance.
I think we just did it for fun at the time, and just because it was something we liked to do. Then we definitely started getting a lot more popular and started adding members to the team.
And they've also got companies sending them free gadgets and accessories to review. The boys also go out and interview local business managers like Roberto Hoyos.
Throwboy.com, they make awesome pillows like this one, very geeky, nerdy style pillows.
The business owner treated the youngsters dead seriously.
What they're doing is almost like when people go, hey, let's go play store, or hey, let's play news reporter today. But now you can make it into a real thing, and people can actually see it, and people can subscribe to it, and people can click on your advertisements and all the sorts of things. You know, you can actually make money off of it.
The 11 and 12-year-olds at Omnitech News don't feel sorry for businesses still getting used to the cacophony of unknown, uncredentialed critics. Lucas Reif is aware of the variable quality of web media out there.
I think that we're definitely trying to be professional in what we do. People who do this like individually down in their basement, like, I think that they need to up the game because there are a lot of other people out there who do the same stuff.
Perhaps in a sign of things to come, one of the tech kids' grade school teachers asked when he could buy stock in the nascent enterprise. For NPR News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Redmond, Washington.
Well, it's that time of year. College students are all heading back to campus. But by next fall, students at New York University will have several campus locations to choose from, both in Manhattan and one also nearly 7,000 miles away. And in a moment, we'll speak to the president of one of America's largest private schools, NYU. He hopes to redefine what it means to be a global university. But first, we're joined by another college administrator who's also drawing attention for his innovations in the field of education, specifically teaching naked. Don't worry, it's not exactly what it sounds like. We're speaking to Jose Bowen. He's dean of the Meadow School of Arts at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, and he joins us from member station KERA. Professor Bowen, welcome.
Hello.
So in addition to being dean, you're also a music history professor, and you've been promoting what I understand is a style called teaching naked. That is conjuring some pretty disturbing images when I think of my professors back in college. So let me just let you explain what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, thank goodness it's radio.
Exactly. No images
but
to look at.
The idea is that technology now enables us to push some of the content acquisition out of the classroom onto the web. So while it sounds like it's an anti-technology position, really what I'm doing is using technology like podcasts and online games and things so that students have first contact with the material before they come to class.
So I'm one of your students. I'm getting ready to come to a class. I would have a lot of stuff to do ahead of time. And when I get to class, it's just discussion, debate.
Exactly. And there are lots of things that you can do. In fact, we do lots of debates. We do project. We create outline histories of the period we're talking about. So we invert the traditional classroom, which is I go to class unprepared, and the professor gives me first contact with the material. Then I go away, and I learn the material. Then I come back and you test me. How about inverting that? Why not? First contact with the material is about you, the student. Then you come into the classroom, and now we have what's called learning. We work together. We argue. And then you go away and I assess you.
And it feels like your message might be to colleges and universities, if you don't start thinking about that, thinking about giving a reason to come to the classroom, that they might be in trouble in coming years.
Well, I'm quite sure we're going to be in trouble if we don't change. Now, we are medieval institutions. We haven't changed in a very long time. And our basic mode of operation is based upon medieval technology. I mean, the lecture was an efficient way to deliver content 1,000 years ago. It's just not anymore. And I'm a parent. I'm looking at college choices for my daughter. You know, I look at the variation in price. You know, is it worth 10 times more to take this course in the flesh than it is to take it online?
Well, Professor Jose Bowen, you've been encouraging professors to take all the technology and so forth out of the classroom. And I want to look at an example of some of that technology. I went to your website and downloaded a game that you made for your students. I'm looking at sort of a mock photo of an empty stage right now. And I get to select musicians to create a swing quartet.
Right. So if you go over to the left-hand side, you'll see right. different instruments. So, you know, click on the drum tab and then a bunch of drummers
show
up. All
right. So I'm clicking on the drum tab. Baby Dodds, Chico Hamilton, Art Blakey. I can pick just one of them. And
just pick randomly, and you'll notice he starts to
all
play.
Right, we got a little beat going there. Now I'm going to pick another instrument.
Now go to bass and add a bass to that.
All right. Adding a bass.
And the bass.
I'm adding Ray Brown. There's a little photo of Ray Brown. Then Ray Brown shows up on stage, his face, and playing the bass. It's pretty cool.
And then add a piano to that.
All right. Adding the piano as we speak. Let's do a little Dave Brubeck. And there's Dave Brubeck on the stage. Now I see these three faces on the stage. Do I keep adding?
Yeah, add a trumpet player now.
I think the pieces I'm adding are coming together pretty well. How about a little Miles Davis? Now I see a grade at the bottom. Do I go see what my score was?
Yeah, go click on grade.
All right.
And it should, or...
The following were incorrect. Trumpet, drums, bass, piano. So I got none right?
Well, that's okay. But see, the point is that when you make it a game, students, they'll play. And so you can actually create a band that never existed. Baby Dodds never played with Miles Davis.
I see. So that's where I got it wrong. Those matches didn't go together.
But part of what happened is that you immediately started listening to the music, which is the real point.
Right.
It's actually pretty easy to memorize, you know, that Gene Krupa is a swing drummer. But in some ways, part of the fun is just hearing different styles and hearing what happens when you change drummers or you change piano players. And so creating a band that never existed has just as much pedagogical value as getting it right.
We've been listening to Jose Bowen. He's dean at Southern Methodist University's Meadows School of the Arts, and he is a big proponent of teaching naked. That's using technology outside of the classroom instead of in it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you may want to try Jose Bowen's jazz games yourself. You can find the link to download them at thenewnpr.org. Awesome New Republic was named the best band in Miami by the Miami New Times this year. They also recently appeared on an episode of the popular TV series The Hills. Not too bad for a band that gets around record labels by encouraging file sharing.
The first thing we did in 2004 was we got a web address and we put up 4 or 5 albums of music for free. And that was how we promoted ourselves and how we got gigs for our first tour.
That was Michael John Hancock from the band Awesome New Republic. To find out more about how entertainers are using technology, go to npr.org/soapbox. There you'll find a link to Queena Kim's podcast, cyberfrequencies.com, which is devoted to stories buzzing on the web. It's all part of Maker's Quest, a project of the Association of Independence in Radio Incorporated and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
And finally this hour, a tribute to guitar master Les Paul. He was best known for the electric guitar that bears his name. He was also a star in his own right as a musician and a pioneer in multi-track recording. Les Paul died today of complications from pneumonia 1 week after his 94th birthday. NPR's Tom Cole has this appreciation.
Les Paul was first and foremost a musician. His understanding of music, and especially the guitar, enabled him to dream about electrifying his instrument and recording it in layers. But he could play.
it's like a butterfly. It's just a lightning speed, but accurate and musical.
That's Jeff Beck, who's done some pretty fierce picking on his Les Paul from a promotional CD released to celebrate his hero's 90th birthday.
I used to sit there and drool over how he did things, you know, just hitting the notes and letting three fingers peel off each of the strings. You could do amazing things with that. He had it all.
Les Paul started on the harmonica as a kid in his hometown, Waukesha, Wisconsin. He was born Lester William Paulfus, and he was a born entertainer. At the age of 8, he was making money, as he told me in 1996.
I would go out there and stand on a table, play at the Kiwanis Club, and make $5 singing cowboy songs, playing the harmonica. But my love was with Earl Hines and Coleman Hawkins.
Jazz players that he'd heard on the radio. Paul moved to Chicago and landed his own radio shows, playing country in the morning for one station and jazz at night for another.
When I heard Fats Waller, when I heard all these other great players, I knew that jazz is where I'd like to go. And you know, I dropped from $1,000 a week as a country singer down to $5 a week as a jazz player.
And that was Les Paul's conundrum and the arc of his career. Popular entertainer or musical innovator? Performer or tinkerer? His father was an auto mechanic, and some of that must have rubbed off. Paul traced it back even further.
Back to when I was in my crib and the train went by. And I says, when that train reaches that speed, my bay window is moving, Mom.
Les Paul delighted in telling stories of his discoveries. He took the diaphragm out of a telephone handset and wired it to his radio to make his voice come out of the speaker. He made his own disc cutter out of a Cadillac flywheel. In 1941, Paul constructed his famous log, as it was called, a 4x4 piece of lumber with strings and a pickup. While others were also experimenting, it was his first solid-body electric guitar. Didn't go over so well, so he continued working on it at the same time he was experimenting with something called sound on sound. Paul would record a guitar part onto a disc, then play that part back while playing a second part along with it, and record them both onto a second disc. He'd repeat the process over and over. The Les Paul sound was born. Les Paul got his first tape recorder from Bing Crosby and went to the Ampex Corporation, which had been working with the Navy on developing multiple-track data recording. Paul's musician's ears told him he could use it for something else.
Dear one, the world is waiting for the sunrise.
In 1949, Les Paul married singer Colleen Summer. He changed her name to Mary Ford, and in the home studio Les built, they created million-selling records. The radio show they did from home ran for 7 years. But there was a downside to success. Mary wanted more of a home life. Les was obsessed with music. They divorced. Then, paradoxically, Les retired from the business for 10 years. He made his comeback in 1974 with an old friend, Chet Atkins.
You see that red light, Chet? Don't get it confused. That means we're on the air.
The record they made together won Les Paul his first Grammy. A decade later, at the age of 69, Les Paul began performing regularly at a New York jazz club.
All my life, I was torn between being commercial and playing jazz.
It was a gig he kept almost until the end, playing well into his 90s when arthritis slowed the lightning fingers. But for him, the most important thing was connecting with an audience.
I never go to my dressing room. I go right off that stage and I go over and talk to him at the bar, at the tables. I think the most important thing to do is to get out there and do what you were put on this earth to do. And I know mine was to love the guitar and play it and to be with other people.
And that's how Les Paul should be remembered. Tom Cole, NPR News.
Les Paul died today. He was 94 years old. You can hear more Les Paul recordings and interviews with him at the new NPR.org.
Yeah, no, that's the first time I knew you weren't the greatest.
greatest. Let's go back and play again, Chet.
All right.
Look at this one.